Once more into the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I am Jake McClure, your singleton host this time around. Jeff is still off enjoying the crisp mountain air of Colorado. What better time to enjoy it than in the middle of summer? So while he's enjoying it, I'll run this radio program, and hopefully I can maintain a modicum of your interest during the 2 hour period. If you would like to join the conversation with me, have questions or comments about the economy, about what's causing our great growth or what the dangers are, the phone numbers to call in here is, there's only one phone number to call in here. 254-773-1400. And I'm going to go ahead and get started. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm registered with the SEC out of Salado, Texas. This is a disclosure because the registration with the SEC doesn't say that the SEC says anything good or bad about us. It's just they're our regulatory authority. If I say something really misleading, they're the ones that you would tell on me too. Said it. Yep, that's how you do it. So the Personal Wealth Coach, we've been giving fiduciary investment advice out of the building in Salado for quite a long time. I guess 18 years in the building in Salado, and fiduciary advice in there for a big chunk of that time. I've been in business with Jeff, who happens to be my dad. He's usually my co-host here, with him since 1991. So that puts it at 27 years for me. He's been doing it since 1982. So we're talking about, goodness, 36 years for him. We've been doing it a long time. We've learned a lot, and the way you learn best, or at least the way we learn best, is by making mistakes. So we have a bit of a motto of never make the same mistake again. We haven't been able to completely avoid making same mistakes again, but the better way of saying the motto is always make new mistakes, because you're not going to be able to avoid making the mistakes. Learn from them. So what's happened this week in the market? The S&P 500, which we think is of the widely publicized indexes, is the one that represents the best part of the market. It's the most likely to be close to your average person's gauge of what's going on in the world. So the S&P 500 this week, for the week, was down. It was down about 1.03%. So not a great week. There's been a lot of news in the week. So it closed at 2,871.68. That's up year to date for 2018. That's still up 7.41% and 16.67% for a 12-month period. We're still solidly in a bull market here. We've had a wobbling around for the past probably 3 or 4 months. And the reason why we had the downturn this week, it's pretty easy to point at when the downturns happened and what was going on in the national discussion. It was over tariffs, threatened tariffs this time. We've got another $200 billion of threatened tariffs against China, which is not the whole picture, because China always retaliates if we give them a tariff. So we're getting very close, if this threat goes through, to tariffing 100% of what we import from China. And they will get quite close to tariffing 100% of what they import from us. Okay, so what does that even mean? I've gotten more questions from people about tariffs and trying to understand what tariffs are and what they mean and how they so often have the opposite result of what they intended to have. So I'm going to give some history. Adam Smith, who's the founder of the whole economic school that we call capitalism, a Scottish guy. I've been to his gravesite in Scotland, as has my father. He wrote a series of books called The Wealth of Nations, where he very carefully studied different forms of taxation. What was the best? Because first off, we got to say taxes are necessary. And nobody likes taxes, including the people that collect the taxes. Nobody likes taxes, but taxes are necessary. We can't fix potholes at the local level without taxes. We can't afford a military or law enforcement or Medicare or any of the things that we consider coming from a government without taxes. This is pretty obvious stuff, but we're going to start basic. Where did our current system come from? Well, our current income tax system, on one part, property tax for the local and sales tax for the state, they all kind of grew over time. Property taxes are one of the oldest forms of taxes, just not in their current state, where you own property, therefore you owe a percentage of the value of that property or a percentage of what that property produces to the government. Whether that be a feudal lord above one another feudal lord, or a democratic republic like we have now, so originally the vast majority of the United States' tax revenue came from tariffs. So this concept of tariff as being a new thing or as being something that nobody understands. It was the only form of taxation that was used at the beginning of our country. In fact, all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century, we used tariffs as the vast majority of the revenue to the United States government. That's how we paid for the military that we had through all the different conflicts that we had. And there's also borrowing that comes in. But tariffs are a tax. It's like a little bit like a sales tax. And if you think of it in that sense, who pays a sales tax? You could attempt to claim that the sales tax is paid by the business that's making the sale. But they've just raised the price of the item that they're selling to you. So the reality comes back to a tariff is a tax on a consumer. The end buyer of a product is the one that gets taxed with a tariff. Okay, well, if you hold that in your mind, because that's kind of the fundamental issue that gets missed in today's debate. They're missing the part about it being, number one, a tax. The big noise is that it's targeted at specific countries. Take a moment to follow the money trail back. And what you'll find is that while tariffs can have a massive impact on countries that are targeted with them, the end payer of that tax is always the citizen of the country that levied the first tariff, or any tariff for that matter. So if China's levying a tariff against the United States, who pays that? Well, the citizens of China pay that when they pay more for an American product. So as we export to them, they import from us, whatever that is. We'll give, usually economists get into widgets, and I don't even know what a widget is. I've used widgets as an example for a long time. I'm going to use an iPhone because iPhones are status symbols in China. If they're paying more for an iPhone in China to use the iPhone, and they are, they pay more. The amount that they pay more, some of that goes to the government coffers of China. If you're paying more for a fidget spinner that came out of China, the more some of that more that you're paying is going to the coffers of the U.S. government. So what's wrong with that? Well, on the surface, absolutely nothing is wrong with that. As long as we understand it's a tax system. It's a voluntary tax system in that you don't have to pay that tax if you don't buy the fidget spinner. If you don't buy the thing from China, you don't have to pay the tax. If China's the only one that sells products that you want, then you're going to pay the tax. But that's up to you. So in a sense, a tariff is a sales tax. Again, it comes right back to the consumers paying it. Here's the issue. When a hefty country imposes a tariff on a less hefty country, when the, if you just measure heftiness by size of economy, it isn't in a vacuum because we've got different currencies being used here. In the United States, if we were just selling inside the United States, there are sales taxes that are different at each state, and they amount to tariffs. So Texas has a sales tax of 6.25% all the way to 8.5%, depending on which community and municipality you're in. So we're going to go ahead and say 8.5% because that's max. You can't pay more than that. 8.5% tariff on Massachusetts or on Connecticut or on California. If you're buying something from California on Amazon, you're going to pay 8.5% on it. That money goes directly to the state of Texas. We understand that. That's a tariff. It's a sales tax tariff. You pay the same thing if you're buying something in Texas that was made in Texas, though. That makes it a level playing field. The people in Texas are not granted an exemption just because they made the item in Texas from the sales tax. That wouldn't be a very good revenue generator because we don't import enough. Well, we import a lot, but not enough to run the economy of Texas, to run the government of Texas. We would have lots of shortfalls if we didn't tax stuff that was made and then sold in Texas. So if you think of a tariff as a sales tax that the people of the country, if you're making something, you don't have to pay. What that does is creates an imbalanced competition. Again, Adam Smith wrote a whole book in The Wealth of Nations on tariffs. And Adam Smith, for those of you who are not familiar with his name, he is probably the greatest single influencing mind on our Constitution and on our Declaration of Independence. His writings influenced our founding fathers so much that they built a country based on it. And he warned against tariffs. Tariffs were the majority of income to a majority of revenue to governments at the time. And he warned about setting tariffs in a practical way that was expected, that was reasonable, and that allowed good business practices to continue afterwards. You still have to fund the government. That's his idea. You got to fund the government, but let's do it in a way that doesn't put anybody out of business or that doesn't fund the government next year. So tariffs as an act of aggression, as a statement of you did bad, I'm going to hurt you for it, have been around as long as tariffs have. The problem with them as an act of aggression is they wind up hurting the aggressor more than the defendant. And I'll give you an example, because we just started this idea of these two hefty nations, one heftier nation imposing a tariff on a less hefty nation. The rest of the world is also a part of this, because we're going to use the United States and China. That's the existing example, the experiment underway right now. United States begins levying tariffs on the world, and specifically on China in a much larger degree. China responds by levying tariffs on the United States. Okay, that's where we are. This is the reality of what exists. The rest of the world looks at the two economies and votes with their money. They look at the two economies, and one economy, the Chinese economy, has the yuan, or the renminbi. We're going to call it the yuan for this episode. So the yuan is sitting there. It's the currency. It's really hard to trade that currency on the world stage. So people that have the currency don't know if it's going to be harder or easier in the future to trade it. So a lot of them have sold the yuan. China's always been enforcing this concept of we don't want to trade the yuan outside of China. because they're afraid of currency manipulators, because they did it for a long time. They did currency manipulation. They don't want somebody to do it to them. Well, on the world stage, the foreign exchange market, the yuan has been taking a drubbing. Now, that's what the headline will say. The yuan has fallen against the dollar. The dollar has risen against the yuan. On the surface, that sounds like the United States is winning. Unfortunately, there's more to the story. Because if the dollar's getting stronger, it means it can buy more yuan than it used to be able to. It means that we can buy more things from China. Just think about that for a second. We just made importing something from China more expensive. The act of doing that caused the dollar to rise, which made importing things from China less expensive. It canceled itself out. China is getting more purchases from us. Our trade deficit with China just hit record levels. It started spiking, shooting straight up when the tariffs were levied. It's having the opposite impact of what was wanted. Our president measures the success of our economy based on trade deficits. I have said that we have said on this program for a decade that those are bad metrics because they don't talk about who owns the money, only where the money's going. If you're spending a lot of money at Walmart, it may look like you're having a massive issue. If you're spending 80% of your money at Walmart, it looks like, whoa, you're losing all your money. What's going on there? But if you're buying things that you've been wanting to buy for a while, and you're getting a good that is worth the price, it's an equal balance. You have gotten what you wanted for that money. There's no trade imbalance if you bought more from Walmart than you sold to Walmart because you bought what you wanted. And Walmart doesn't really want to buy your stuff. I don't know why. I keep trying to sell my shoes to them and they won't buy it. So this concept of imbalance of trade, number one, doesn't include who owns the money, just where the money's going. Where is it coming from and where is it going to? If it's owned by an American and it goes to another country, and it's still owned by the same American, and then it comes back to this country, did we export and then import that money? Well, yeah, it left with the American, and it came back with the American. But nothing really happened there. The American didn't spend it at any place. They just happened to carry it. Well, from a export-import standpoint, it also starts to cancel out. Unless we say country only. What if that American is an artist and they're carrying paper with them when they go on vacation? And while they're on vacation in another country, they create a beautiful artwork on that paper and then bring it back. If we were to measure as a deficit, we just imported a fabulously valuable piece of artwork from a country. We have a deficit with them now. Except that it's not a real deficit. It's only on paper, and it's not even really good on paper. The value of that artwork is still attributed to the person that created it, not the country that that person was in when it was created. The same is true when we're talking about corporations. If a corporation is owned in huge part, vast majority, by American citizens, and they go to another country, they take things with them to that other country, and while they're in that other country, they manufacture something out of the things they took with them, and they bring it back. I don't consider that a deficit. Even if there were foreigners involved in the creation of that item, the foreigners, in this case, we'll use a direct example of automobile manufacturing. Before this new version of NAFTA goes into place, if it goes into place, we don't know, the average hourly wage of a Mexican employee at an American corporation auto manufacturing facility in Mexico is $2 an hour, which is much greater than the $1.50 a day, which is the normal pay for a Mexican. So $2 an hour means it costs less to make it in Mexico. We could come to the United States and the hourly wage is somewhere around $30. So it's going to cost more to make that thing. On the surface of that, that sounds like, okay, we're giving a lot of money to Mexico. Except that the markup on the automobile itself, that machine, is worth a lot more than the difference between the hourly costs. So now it's a question over who's getting the hourly costs, and now it's a direct effort by the government to regulate the commerce of a business. That's different from an attack on Mexico. It's different than an attack on China. It's saying our workers aren't being paid enough. We need to pay them more. The danger here is that we're already at a cusp in history where we're going to less workers across the board. We have automation stepping in. We have robots, real, honest-to-goodness robots that are autonomous, not just doing the same bolt over and over again, but actually deciding which bolt that they're going to do. They have some degree of intelligence in what they're doing. If you go from a $2 an hour job to a $30 an hour job, that's a big raise. It hurts the corporation. The corporation may look at your annual salary and say a machine is worth less than the amount we would pay you for 1 year. So we're going to replace that whole job with this. We won't be bringing jobs home in this tariff. We'll be boosting automation. That, I think, long-term is a good move. I don't think this is the best way to approach it. I like the normal market forces directing the prices, normal market forces saying what's the next thing we should do. I think anytime the government gets involved in setting up which new technology needs to be the next new big thing, we get imbalances. And I'm going to give you a completely side demonstration to say that I'm not anti-Trump, although I don't like the trade policies. Barack Obama, for many years, gave tax credits for solar panels. Tax credits to the companies that make the solar panels. Tax credits to the people that bought the solar panels. There are municipalities that give huge tax incentives and energy incentives if you buy solar panels. Well, they're not profitable on their own, but when you throw in the taxes, it suddenly becomes profitable. Here's the problem with that. Innovation at the manufacturing point in photovoltaics, that's solar energy, innovation has basically stopped there, even though on the research end, you go over to the research end, and we have made leaps and bounds in the efficiency for photovoltaic power. We have huge advances going on there, but it hasn't hit the manufacturing facilities. The reason why it hasn't hit the manufacturing facilities is because it costs money to change the industrial line, to get new machines to make the new products that have such great innovations. And why should they do it if they're so massively profitable right now based on tax incentives? They're not profitable based on the price that they're charging. They're profitable based on the fact that the government is giving them money. This is the old welfare system. The government is, through the Obama administration, although it's still hanging around out there, has been incentivizing photovoltaics. So that's great. I think it's a good idea to go to clean energy. Don't get me wrong there. I think it's fantastic. But as long as we subsidize something, we're not getting any hunger in the mix, and hunger is the father of innovation. You've got to be hungry. You've got to be bored to go forward and change the way you're doing things. If you're so busy doing something and it's very profitable right now, you don't have time to say, I'm going to redesign everything that we're doing. Why should you? You're being paid well enough as it is, and you don't have time. So tariffs are like subsidies to industries, only they're reverse subsidies. There's no actual extra benefit going to automobile companies that build their cars in the United States. None. They just have penalties for doing it elsewhere. That is like a reverse incentive, but it doesn't work any better than the original one. Because if the American worker gets used to being without competition, what we get is a repeat of the 1970s. What happened in the 1970s? Well, we went from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, where the rest of the world had been, in essence, bombed flat by each other and us. World War II had happened. We had annihilated the industrial capacity of many nations. Japan, Germany, England, France, Poland, Russia, China, it goes on. All of their industrial capacity was essentially flattened, and we still had ours. So we were pumping out cars, and the rest of the world were buying them. Over time, the industrial capacity grew back. But we in the United States had gotten so used to lack of competition that we had things like planned obsolescence built into our automobiles, where we knew we were building an automobile that was designed to fail in 3 to 5 years so that you would come back and buy another one. That's not good for the marketplace. It's great for the competitors, though. So the competitors come in, the German companies and the Japanese companies and the Italian companies, making cheap cars to come in to compete. And we didn't even try to compete at the cheap level. We didn't get our game face on and say, all right, we're going to go to town on this. We just gifted them the cheap market in automobiles because we weren't used to using competitive techniques anymore. And over time, the Japanese imports became more and more quality, more and more expensive, until they are neck and neck and now past the United States companies for sales in the United States. We're back on the competitive footing. We're back there saying, all right, on our automobiles, we got to be competitive about this. We got to build them better. We got to build them cheaper. We've got to make sure that we're not giving crazy incentives to union employees, not based on merit, but just because they exist. At the same time, we're looking around and saying there's not enough people to work the jobs. So we've got to build in places that we've never built before, like Canada and Mexico. They've got workers up there that don't have jobs. We all have jobs, so let's build there. And in the process, our supply chain, parts being built in one country, moving to another country to be assembled into more complicated parts, moving to another country to be assembled into the final product, the supply chain got complex based on best price. So this is our move to be competitive. American workers still have the greatest productivity of any developed nation on the planet. So hold that in your mind a second. They have this entire time. That's measurable. For hours worked and price paid, we make better products than the rest of the industrialized world. That includes Germany. People know that. American products are better, but you pay more for them. So our effort to bring the price down so that we can compete on an international level has caused us to use external workers, which has directly impacted workers at automobile plants. They've lost their jobs over it. Now, if you look at the numbers, the people that lost their jobs at these plants, for the very large part, have gotten better paying jobs by now doing something else. There are still some people that are unemployed on it, but the vast majority have gone on to better things. They're doing better than they were before. A tariff now will cause our goods to be more expensive because we're getting our steel and our aluminum overseas. We're getting our parts overseas. We're manufacturing them there. Even if it's an American company that's mining the steel and the aluminum, somewhere else. It costs more here. So our products become more expensive here. It causes inflation. We're seeing inflation. 2018, so far, we're running about a 2.9% inflation rate. The Federal Reserve's target is 2%. So that means things are more expensive, kind of across the board, by about 3%. Now, the good news is that pay scales are going up. The largest increase in pay is happening at the lowest pay level. So this is something that we said on this program was going to be the final thing as a recovery from the recession. When the pay at the lowest end of the spectrum starts going up, that means that we are well and truly recovered. So that's where we are. Pay on the whole, hourly wages on the whole, is up about 6.2%. Inflation is up 2.9%. That means people have a real increase in pay. Productivity is also up. Even with prices going up, productivity going up. If we can keep the productivity going up, we don't get inflation. Unfortunately, productivity is not going up fast enough to avoid the inflation because so much of what we buy is from overseas. And it's more expensive in many cases to buy things overseas, less due to tariffs and more due to reaction to tariffs. But it's causing inflation. So tariffs as a tax, if you can hang on to that piece by itself, it's a reverse incentive. So if you think of a subsidy to a solar panel company, the government is actually either writing them a check or telling them not to write a check to hang on to the money. With a tariff, the government is just penalizing everyone else, but not giving any incentive, no monetary incentive to the American company. They're just hanging on to it. And this kind of comes back to one last piece of this, and then I'm going to move on to some commercials. And that is, people have heard me talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I'm not a big fan. Neither is the president. I like the concept of having an organization that's going out there and trying to find scammers. I love that concept. If we can look at the market and make sure that we don't have snake oil salesmen as the norm, then that's a really good thing. But when you tell an organization that their job is to police that market, they don't get any funding except from the fines that they levy, you've just created a piranha. You've just created a shark to swim around inside your swimming pool with you. Because now their only incentive is to maintain themselves. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is funded in small part by Congress, in large part by the fines that they levy against corporations for breaking rules. So Wells Fargo, lots of scandals. They've had lots and lots and lots of scandals. They've, in essence, been caught again and again and again stealing money from their customers. This isn't breaking news. This is just what's happened. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau charges them record-breaking fines. And I think, all right, that's going to go to the customers of Wells Fargo that were injured in this. Nope, it goes to the government coffers. But not just any government coffers, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's coffers, for them to go on and do it again. That's a problem. I don't like self-funded governmental entities whose job it is to attack the economy. I want a police force, absolutely, that goes out there and investigates scams against the elderly, that gives fines to gold purchasers that are literally stealing things from people. And literally, there's no other way of looking at it. They are stealing. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as a concept began as a good concept, and it's become a monster. It was written into law with the idea that it didn't have to answer to anybody, including the president. So Donald Trump said, nope, I don't believe that we can't have somebody in the government that's not answerable to anybody, that's allowed to levy fines, and that they exist off of the fines that they levy. So he's ratcheted down their power. Great move. the SEC is back up to five commissioners. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. They are the regulatory authority for the marketplace. If we're going to maintain the idea that wrongdoers must be punished in the market, then the SEC is the one to do it. So we're back up there. Congratulations to the Trump administration. We are back up to a full commission in the SEC. That is fantastic. A lot of times people hear me talking about the problems with what's going on out there. The reality is that we are in a golden era. We are in an era in the economy where things are rocking. We are doing fantastically well. We are definitely at full capacity. We cannot grow faster than this. We've got some bumps ahead. But the reality is that the growth that we're seeing right now is directly due to actions of the Congress and this administration. Credit where credit is due. When I look at the leading economic indicators, those of you that listen to this program very often know that we look at those regularly. Every month when they come out, we dig into the nitty-gritty. There are a couple of other indicators that go along with them. The concurrent, that's the present-day indicators, and then the lagging indicators. This last month, August 17, the indicators came out, and something kind of hidden in the mix. The leading indicators are growing. They're not growing at a stellar rate, but it means that we're not due for a recession anytime soon, according to history and how well this has worked. But the lagging indicators were negative. Now think about that for a second. That lagging indicator is when we look back on what's just happened in the economy. And what's just happened in the economy, the last two quarters, we've had really nice growth. But the lagging indicators for those same quarters were negative. What does that mean? It means that the underlying portions of the economy that aren't due to the tax cut and aren't due to the earnings and extra spending that happened because of the tax cut, we would have seen a little dip. We would have seen a slight slowdown in the first two quarters of this year without the tax cut, without the regulatory reform. So on the surface, that sounds great as well. We do need to have dips. That's how we get rid of the bad wood. That's how we get rid of the rot. We got to maintain good health, and the only way you do that is by taking a moment every once in a while to look around and say, wait, these companies are completely not profitable. Let's get rid of them. That usually only happens in the downturns. Philip Corray is famous for saying you don't know who's not wearing their swimming suit until the tide goes out. Well, we need dips occasionally. It's nice that we didn't have one this year. It's nice that it doesn't look like we're going to have one for a couple of years. But that means you can't see what's going on under the water. There could be a lot of lack of bathing suits out there. So it means due diligence is really important when you're doing your investing. Because the healthy and the unhealthy are swimming in the same waters right now. The rising tide has lifted all boats. And all those boats, how about that for a metaphor switch? So boats wearing swimming suits being lifted. Anyway, we got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, I have been on a soapbox, and I would love to hear some other input. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I'm Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I've got lots more to talk about. How the unemployment rate went this last week, all the good stuff that we talk about, and if you agree with me that it's good stuff, then you're on the right station, because most people look at that stuff as pure boring. All right, we'll play some commercials and be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join the program, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. All right, so what's going on with unemployment, interest rates, mortgages, the yield curve, all the things that that we in the know like to talk about. What does in the know mean? It's kind of a silly statement because none of us really know anything. On the interest rate sides, the Treasury yield curve, we look at that on a regular basis. Usually we cover this at the beginning of the episode. The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury is up. It's up based on unemployment numbers. It's up almost to the 3% point again, 2.941%. That's really close to 3%. So this concept of rising interest rates, of inflation, I talked before the break, inflation's running about 2.9% for the year. Well, the Federal Reserve's target is 2%. So we should expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. What does that mean? What it means is that banks are being charged slightly more money anytime they raise that rate if they've overloaned for a given day. So I'm going to give kind of a quick overview of how this rate that the Federal Reserve touches when they all the news says they've raised the rates or haven't raised the rates or what they're going to do. What does that even mean to you? Banks have some regulations. That's putting it lightly. They are not allowed to loan out too much money. If they've got $100 on deposit, if they loaned out $100 and then you showed up and you were the one that put the money on deposit and you say, I'm writing a check, well, the bank wouldn't be able to honor the check. They need to have some money on hand that they haven't loaned out. You know, they make their money by loaning money. You put the money with the bank to keep from losing money. So their profits don't come from what they charge you, although there's some tiny amount that comes from that. It comes much more from using your money to make a loan to someone else and charge interest on it, and initiation fees and hazing fees and parking under the bridge fees and all that other stuff that banks tack onto all the loans. All that stuff is where they get their profit. They are required to keep a certain amount of the money on deposit available for depositors. That seems like common sense, but it's not something that bankers have done forever. Bankers only do that when they're told by the government you've got to do that. Because if profit is your motivation, why stop at 80%? Why not go 100%? So the Federal Reserve says you're required to maintain some of the deposit on hand in case the depositor wants to buy something. So at the end of the day, and this is why bankers' hours are the way they are for so long, banks closed at 3 o'clock. It wasn't because they didn't believe that people should work beyond 3 o'clock. In fact, they stayed in the bank working after 3 o'clock. They just closed the doors. They lock up the doors. They're not letting people in the bank anymore because they're doing their internal audit for their loans. The loan officers haven't been telling each other exactly at the moment how much money they've loaned out. They got to make sure that they haven't loaned out too much money for the day. If they have, before the closing time at the Federal Reserve in the local area, they've got to get a loan either from another bank or directly from the Federal Reserve. Well, the Federal Reserve is just a group of banks. And that loan that they get, it's called the interbank lending rate. That's the bank-to-bank overnight interest rate that they're charging. So if you get, if you're a bank and you get a loan from the Federal Reserve, that's the interest rate that gets moved around when the Federal Reserve is raising and lowering rates. What they're saying to the banks is slow down on the overloaning. You're loaning a little too much. Things are heating up. There's too much money moving into the economy. Well, the money moving into the economy right now isn't from loans. It's from taxes. You're paying less in taxes. Corporations are paying less in taxes. So there's a lot more cash on hand. So raising the rates at the banks to say to the banks, stop loaning so much when they're not really loaning enough. It's one of the tools available for the Federal Reserve. Taxes coming in causing inflation. The Federal Reserve cannot tell the United States government, stop giving money back to the people. Now, usually when we see inflation like this, it's starting because of loans. It is kind of the same way now, because that big tax cut that we did is being funded. We're still doing the same things we were doing before the tax cut as far as the government expenditures, plus some. We're spending more. But we lowered taxes. Revenue went down with it. Where are we getting the money for the government to continue to do what it was doing, plus some, and you to have extra money? The government's borrowing it. So the Federal Reserve doesn't have any say over the interest rate on the treasuries at the short end of the spectrum, U.S. treasuries. They have had for a long time a say on the longer-term treasuries because they purchased them during the recession. But they're selling them now. When you sell things, when you've got a lot of them available, the interest rate is pretty low because everybody's saying, all right, there's enough money flowing around in here. It's supply and demand. People are selling more than buying. That means that they don't have to raise the interest rate on the long end. The government is getting loans on the short end, on the two-year and the 5-10 year periods. The government is going out there and making a lot of borrowing. It's pulling in a lot of money from different locations. That's causing interest rates on the short end to go up. When you can make a loan to someone and charge them more for a short-term loan than a long-term loan, it means people aren't investing long-term. Nobody's demanding long-term loans, which means people aren't buying equipment items. They're not buying the things that produce good income later, which is why when we look at the yield curve, if the long-term loan rate is very low and the short-term loan rate is very high, that's not good news for the economy. Well, we're very close to completely flat across that spectrum. It's very close. The difference between a two-year loan to the federal government and a 10-year loan is less than 0.25% for those 8 extra years. That's not a good sign for the economy. So those are things that we're looking at. People are not doing the long-term investment in their businesses that we wanted them to do when the tax cut happened. They are enjoying it. Business investment is up, but it's not up anywhere near what we expected it to be, or what I expected was less than what the Trump administration expected, less than what the Congress expected on the Republican side when they put forward that tax cut. We are producing less revenue for the government, and the growth engine is just not producing enough growth. That has a lot to do with highways, railroads, fiber optics, lack of people to do jobs. You can't grow faster than you have the manpower or woman power or highway power or railroad power to grow. If you're trying to double the amount of fidget spinners that you're selling, but you can't get fidget spinners to the place that you're selling fast enough, you're not going to double the sales. So infrastructure issues keep popping up. We have a golden situation, but we really do have to concentrate on the things that drive growth long-term rather than a short-term quick flash that we're seeing now. And I'm about out of time for this hour. I'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call the Personal Wealth Coach off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice that's customized to each person, each entity, each foundation, each corporation that we give advice to. We manage investments for those same people. So if you would like to reach voicemail for that great entity, 254-947-1111. There's real live people during the week. You can reach at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email me directly, Jake at tpwc.com or Jeff at